This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
These unidentified individuals are known as microbes, who have carried out these assaults, threats, intimidating protesters, wielding machetes and knives. There are allegations that the modus operandi of these microbes, as they are called, are known to the state authorities.
That was Ravina Shamdasani, a spokesman for the Human Rights Office, on the worrying uptick in violence ahead of the Ivory Coast's presidential election on Saturday. Details coming up. In Nigeria, after days of looting and damage, Lagos and other cities seem to have returned to normal. And Guinea's opposition leader has rejected the country's official election results. All these and more ahead on African News Tonight. But first, our top story. The Lagos state government has set up a commission of inquiry to investigate criminal activity during protests against police brutality. Lagos and other cities in Nigeria have returned to normal after days of looting and damage to infrastructure by people who capitalized on youth protests. Nathaniel Okoro is the head of People's Forum, a Lagos non-governmental organization and businessman. Okoro spoke to reporter Mike Mbonier on the aftermath of the protests and destruction of infrastructure. He says the government should pay compensation to private business owners whose property was vandalized.
Yes, there are still curfews, but for now, it depends on each state. Each state governor will assess the situation in the state and will tailor the curfew according to the prevailing circumstances. For instance, in Lagos, now it has been relaxed to 9 p.m. to 6 a.m. Yeah, this is in reaction to the prevailing circumstances in Lagos. You know, so it's the same thing for every other state. They look at their situation and make it accordingly.
What's your take on the massive looting and destructions that took place in different parts of the country? As a business owner, do you suggest or recommend for compensation to be paid to owners of private businesses and many Nigerians who suffered so much losses during the year? Demonstrations by some hoodlums.
Well, the point is, the government will have to do something. They need to compensate people. Unfortunately, insurance is not very popular with Nigerian businessmen. Otherwise, they would have had insurance for riot and strike, which would have covered things like this. Burglary, riot and strike, fire. You know, but insurance is not very popular. It's unfortunate because people have had bad experience. They take out premium. When it is time to pay, the insurance company will start reading between the lines, the fine prints, and looking for ways to dodge payment. So people are apathetic to insurance. But that is not to say that one should set up a business without insurance. You should insure your business. That's the essence of insurance. You don't know what's going to happen. So you don't take the loss on your own. You want an insurance company to take some losses as well. Having said that, the situation we find ourselves in now, the government would have to pay some compensation and at the same time use the opportunity to advise people and educate them about the usefulness of insurance and let the insurance companies understand that the apathy is because some people have suffered losses and they were not compensated. So all this would have to be done. But to answer your question, yes, the government would have to pay something.
Your NGO, the People's Forum, supported the youths during the NSAS protest. Do you know if there are plans for more protests?
Yes, we had to support Because NSAS protests affect everybody. You can't have a situation where somebody in a ragtag dressing with gun will stop you and say, bring your phone, open it, and all that. If you refuse, the least that will happen to you is you get beaten up. The worst, you lose your life. So it had to stop. Unfortunately, the government was not very quick in reacting. I mean, this complaint started as far back as 2016. And from then to now, 4 years, they didn't do anything. Now they are claiming, yes, they formed committees that was making a recommendation. 4 years until they got to this point. So we have to support the protest. It's the right thing to do. We have to correct a lot of things. There's too much impunity in the system.
Which way forward, as things are now, to avert more protests or to find solutions to the demands of the youth?
Well, more protests, whether there will be more protests or not, will depend on what the government does. Now they know what the complaints are. Now they should understand they don't have 4 years like they did before. They have to immediately bring out solutions. It might not be the end of it, but at least do something to assure people that you understand their pains, you understand their grievances. These and these and these are the things you are going to do in the immediate. And these are the things that you look forward to doing in future to make it permanent. The era of impunity where policy does not evolve from the people. Policies come as instructions from the top down to the people. That era should be gone. You want to evolve a policy, get the people involved. When they're involved, they will not complain when the policy comes into action.
That was Nathaniel Okoro, head of People's Forum, a Lagos non-governmental organization and businessman, speaking with reporter Mike Imbonier. The UN Human Rights Office is urging the government of Ivory Coast to restrain its security forces and curb violent intercommunal clashes and political protests in the run-up to Saturday's presidential elections. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
At least 20 people reportedly have been killed in intercommunal clashes and violent confrontations between Ivorian security forces and opposition protesters. UN Human Rights Monitors report that demonstrations between October 17th and 21st in Bongouanou, Dabou, Abidjan, and other towns have become increasingly violent. The spokeswoman for the Human Rights Office, Ravina Shamdasani, tells VOA there's been a worrying uptick in violent crackdowns on demonstrations by security forces and particularly aggressive attacks by unidentified individuals.
These unidentified individuals are known as microbes who have carried out these assaults, threats, intimidating protesters, wielding machetes and knives. There are allegations that the modus operandi of these microbes, as they are called, are known to the state authorities.
Tension was stoked when President Alassane Ouattara said he would seek a third term, which critics say is unconstitutional. That tension has grown as the election draws closer, as has the use of threatening and discriminatory tactics to stifle dissent. Shamdasani says there's a deeply worrying and persistent use of hate speech aimed at manipulating ethnic differences for political ends.
Given the history of electoral violence in Côte d'Ivoire, we appeal to all parties to refrain from using discriminatory and provocative language along ethnic affiliations that could lead to more divisions in society and ultimately violence.
Thousands were killed in the aftermath of the 2010 election when then-President Laurent Gbagbo refused to concede defeat to Ouattara. The UN Human Rights Office is calling on authorities to conduct prompt, thorough, and impartial investigations into all human rights violations and abuses, regardless of political affiliation, and to hold the alleged perpetrators accountable. The agency is appealing for calm in the lead-up to the October 31st election and in its aftermath to resolve differences through dialogue. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Guinea's opposition leader, Selou Daline Diallo, has rejected official election results that said President Alpha Condé won a third term in office. State media has reported more than 20 deaths in violence that has erupted since the election. VOA Steve Miller speaks to Idris Fall, senior editor with VOA's French to Africa service, to get the latest.
Well, it's very complicated because there is a mediation sent by United Nations, African Union, and ECOWAS. They are since Sunday, and today they call for the government to lift the blockade around the house of Selou Dalein Diallo. What happened before is the Electoral Commission said that Mr. Condé won the election. Before that, the day after the voting, Selou himself proclaimed that victory, and is where we are, and kids went out. The army, according to Amnesty International, used real bullets, and at least 21 people were killed, is where we're standing now. And even Selou Dalein Diallo, the leader of the opposition, said before he does not expect a lot from these mediation from UN, ECOWAS, and AU.
What's been the reaction to those who are experiencing this firsthand on the ground? Because you have a situation where you have two individuals who are claiming victory in the election, and now allegations of real bullets being used to disperse protesters.
Because, you know, Guinea is a country where you have all the time since independence a divide, ethnical divide. Most of the president are supported by the Malinke ethnic, and most of the opponents in Guinea are from the Fulani ethnic, or what we call Peul. Selou Dalein Diallo is Peul, Fulbe. And I think since independence, we have this ethnic divide very clearly, even under former President Sekou Touré. All the opponents come from the Fulbe ethnic group, and they have what had been badly treated. And right now, it's the same thing. When you hear kids going out to contest, mostly they are from the ethnic group of Fulanis, and the army shoot at them. So it's where we are. Internet now is shut down for maybe since last week, and to have access to information is very, very rare.
Given all of that, is there anything in particular that instigated this current round of protests?
Because the main problem came when Alpha Condé decided to run for third mandate. That was the main issue. And a lot of NGOs down there, or political party close to the opposition, they say, was saying that this is not normal. He's 82. He's already run for two mandates. He must leave, including Selou himself, because Selou, this will be the third time he had been running for presidential election. It's for that now I don't see a solution, because himself, he said he's president. And Alpha Condé also was declared winner.
The UN brokered a Libyan ceasefire that was reached by military representatives of the warring sides has been widely hailed as a breakthrough, although Libyan National Army Commander Khalifa Haftar has yet to comment on the agreement. Next up are political talks in Tunisia on November 9th. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi spoke with Jason Pack, a non-resident fellow at the Middle East Institute and founder of Libya Analysis in London, about whether the ceasefire deal and the upcoming political talks could pave the way for a peaceful settlement of the Libyan conflict.
Well, I'm hopeful but not optimistic. Mohamed, you're right to say that this is a step forward towards a peaceful settlement. And essentially what the UN has done is focused on the security track. There is the political track, the security track, and the economic track. The Sakhirat agreement, which failed, was bridging a gap between political stakeholders in various institutions, such as the HOR and then the GNC, and that didn't work. This is a movement in the right direction to try to get people involved with arms and power on the ground involved. Unfortunately, it ignores the economic track, those who make money on corruption and smuggling and subsidies, but progress could be made in Tunis that would take us to involve all of the stakeholders, and hopefully that will lead to a settlement of the conflict.
But Libyan National Army Commander Khalifa Haftar has yet to comment on the ceasefire agreement, and the LNA spokesperson Ahmed Mesmari said that Haftar has not commented on the truce and that he was waiting for his official statement. What do you make of that?
Although security players from the LNA and the GNA-aligned groups constituted the 5+5, which signed the Geneva Agreement, the real power players like Khalifa Haftar in the east and important militia commanders in the west were not signatories. They haven't reacted. They're adopting a wait-and-see approach. Neither Haftar nor any counterparts of his in the west want to be blamed for the ceasefire falling apart. But if it does fall apart, they'll say, you know, that wasn't what I wanted. I didn't really support that. So their non-endorsements does not bode particularly well.
On the other side of the divide, the GNA Defense Ministry called for the immediate withdrawal of all mercenaries from oil facilities and military positions in Libya in a gesture of goodwill ahead of their pullout from the country. However, LNA does not recognize the presence of mercenaries among their ranks. What's your take on that?
It's very easy to call for a goodwill measure that your opponent has to do. The GNA and GNA-aligned militias have no mercenaries in oil facilities because the LNA still controls all of the major oil installations, both in Libya's south, but particularly in the eastern oil crescent. So until we see that Wagner Group mercenaries as well as Sudan Rapid Support Forces are leaving places like Ras Lanuf and Sidra, it won't look like this ceasefire will be real. They have 3 months and a lot can happen from then. And hopefully momentum will be generated in Tunis and monies will be freed from the exporting of oil that will make it beneficial for all sides to move forward. But finally, it will be decided in Istanbul and Moscow if Russia and Turkey want this ceasefire to hold or if they benefit from the war economy.
Spokesman for the GNA's Volcano of Rage operation, Mohammed Qnunu, expressed doubts that the ceasefire would hold. He demanded that the UN dispatch monitors to the central city of Sirte and Jufra, describing them as hotbeds for foreign mercenaries. Would the UN or the European Union send observers to Libya?
I doubt that they will, but it isn't as bad an idea as you might think. Even if you had just 100 German troops, say 50 in Sirte and 50 in Jufra, and I use the term Germans on purpose because they're seen as unbiased, unlike the French or the Italians, that would be a huge disincentive for anyone to attack because no one wants to be blamed for killing some German peacekeepers. So just a small number of peacekeepers could help make the Sirte-Jufra line a lot safer and a lot more secure, not only from various Libyan factions, but from Turkish and Russian forces, as well as from, you know, air attacks and drones. Do I think it's going to happen? No. The EU and the UN have spoken many times in 2014, in 2011, of sending peacekeepers and observers. But when push comes to shove, they don't have the political will, as well as they don't want to spend the money. And then if someone would get killed, they're afraid they will hurt them in their domestic constituencies. So I don't think it's likely, but it's not a bad idea.
That was Jason Pack, a non-resident fellow at the Middle East Institute and founder of Libya Analysis in London, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi. A month after a French court ruled against a request by the accused Rwandan genocide financier to have his trial held in France, Felicien Kabuga was transferred Monday to the UN Tribunal in The Hague. The 84-year-old Kabuga was arrested in a suburb of Paris in May, a month after a French court ruled against a request by the accused Rwandan genocide financier to have his trial held in France. Felicien Kabuga was transferred Monday to the UN Tribunal in The Hague. The 84-year-old Kabuga was arrested in a suburb of Paris in May, following a 26-year manhunt. International Edition's Laurie London speaks to Paris-based reporter Catherine Field.
Mr. Kabuga was seen by medical experts on the 14th of October, who said that he could be transferred, but that he could need to be transferred to The Hague because it's a much easier journey. It's a journey he could make by road. He was transferred to the court facility in The Hague by ambulance in the middle of the day on Monday.
Why not Tanzania, where they were initially expecting to take him?
One of the justifications for his request to be tried here in France was that Mr. Kabuga is suffering from several ailments, notably diabetes, hypertension, and he's got some sort of cognitive impairment. Now, he said that particular group of ailments means that he needs to have specialized medical care 24 hours a day. Now, if he were to get a plane to go to Arusha to stand trial there, that would mean he would have to spend some 11 hours on a plane. He would have to transit through three different airports. And there's also the question of whether or not it is safe for him to be in Tanzania given the coronavirus. So that was the reason why he said he would rather go to The Hague. He also, his defense lawyers told the authorities at the UN, said that Mr. Kabuga wanted to stay in Europe because his family lives in Europe, and he felt that he had a right to a family life, as is verified in various UN declarations on human rights.
So as they are evaluating his health to determine where this trial should ultimately be, how long is this all expected to take?
That is one question we don't have the answer to. We've been given very little information on where everything goes from here. What we know is that what they're describing as in due course, the tribunal will put him before three judges who will decide on how this medical assessment is to be carried out, who will carry it out, under what circumstances. That will be the first thing. We also need to find out when he will go before this tribunal. When will they read out to him those seven criminal charges, which include charges of committing genocide and crimes against humanity? So we're looking really now to see when that will happen. But certainly it's likely to be several months at least before he would be transferred to Arusha, if that does ever come to pass.
You mentioned his family. I'm sure families of the victims and survivors as well are probably concerned given the time they've been waiting and hoping to see some sort of justice.
Indeed, all of the Rwanda genocide survivors groups here in France and also in the Netherlands have been saying this is a very positive step. Yes, he was on the run for more than 20 years. Yes, he did manage to slip through many nets in various countries in Europe and lead a seemingly comfortable life undisturbed here in Europe. But nevertheless, at the end of the day, he is in the hands of the tribunal and they are getting this whole motion in place for him to be able to stand trial for those serious accusations of committing genocide and, of course, for also encouraging others to commit genocide.
Catherine, interestingly enough, on the same day on Monday, there was another arrest related to the 1994 Rwandan genocide. What do we know about this?
Indeed, authorities in the Netherlands issued a statement saying that they had arrested a 71-year-old Rwandan man. He had apparently been living in the Netherlands for the last 20 years. His arrest was ordered following a request for his extradition from authorities in Kigali. We do not know his name. It hasn't yet been released, but he has been described as a former banker and pharmacy owner, and he is accused of having prepared a list of Tutsis to be killed by militias in 1994. Now, that's according to reports we're getting from the Netherlands.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.